Hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We are also streaming live at KUCI.org. Today is Wednesday, February 26, 2020. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. You can find the show archive at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. We're having some trouble with our iTunes feed, so if you need to find past shows, best to go to the archive at Blogger. And today I have a guest in the studio. I have a good friend, memoirist Christina Adams. Hello,
Barbara.
She's sitting right here across from me. She's an award-winning writer with a background in aerospace, government, and health. She has an MFA in creative writing, and her work has been featured by NPR, The Washington Post, The LA Times, Ravishly, WebMD, Global Advances in Health and Medicine, Dubai One, The Rajasthan Patrika, and The Writer. Her first memoir was A Real Boy, published by Penguin. And she's here to talk about her new memoir, Camel Crazy, A Quest for Miracles in the Mysterious World of Camels, published by New World Library. Hello.
Hello, Barbara.
It's so nice to have you here. Let's begin with you talking a bit about how Camel Crazy came about.
Camel Crazy, A Quest for Miracles in the Mysterious World of Camels is a book that very few people could have ever seen coming, and that includes myself. So having gotten my MFA after a career in journalism and corporate things and public relations and all that, I did finish the MFA, and then my son was diagnosed with autism. So that's when I turned kind of my skill set, as it were, to that issue. And the result of that was my first book, A Real Boy, A True Story of Autism, Early Intervention and Recovery, which you mentioned. So after that book came out, I was minding my own business, standing at a community college campus in Orange County, right here. And I saw a guy with a camel, and that kind of changed the course of camel history and autism treatment. So that's why the title is Camel Crazy, because it's a crazy story, but it's all true. And everything to do with camels and their culture is fascinating, crazy, and all true, and very interesting.
So so let's back up a bit. So this was what, 2005?
It was 2005. A Real Boy had come out in May, and, mm-hmm. and this inspiration happened in October.
And your son was how old?
He was 7 at the time.
Okay, so you're at the Orange Coast College?
Orange Coast College, right up the street. And and I was a newly separated mom at the time, which is a fate that you are deeply in fear of if you have a child with special needs. Mm-hmm. And it had just come to pass, 3 weeks I've been separated. And I was at the book festival, and that's where, this kind of time in life had come. What am I going to do? And then I still have my child who is doing great, but I see there's still issues. And so, you know, you just never know where inspiration mm-hmm. is going to come from. And if it comes from a giant beast with a hump on its back, well, you can take that and run with it and make something out of it.
But talk about, like, okay, you're at the college, there's a camel, your son's having, you're dealing with his challenges. How did that all come together? I mean, you talked with the guy who owned the camel.
Yes. Actually, the book starts there. And if we start talking kind of thinking about the writing of a book like this, which is complex, and how to do it and how to tell that story, I actually grappled with that because there are different aspects of this book. But when I actually sat down to finish the manuscript, I was like, where do I start? Where do I start? Do I start with the magnificence of the animal known as the camel? Mm-hmm. Do I start with the cultures? Do I start where? And then I thought, this is the story that everyone wants to hear. So I started there. And so in chapter one, it's actually called Meeting the Camel. And that's where I explain exactly where we were and what we were doing.
Why don't you read that chapter? It's pretty short.
Oh, I would love to.
Yeah.
Chapter one, Meeting the Camel. The camel stands calmly, munching something hay-like, placid in her dirty blonde summer coat. Her great head grows like a question mark from the curve of her muscular neck. Padded, leathery feet keep her comfortable on the bare spots of the lawn. She ignores the children, offering pink tufts of cotton candy. staring at her with freckles wringing the O's of their open mouths. She was trundled in a horse van to this college in Orange County, California, 2 hours in a rocky mountain from her home in fire-scorched farm country. Her eyes watched the humans scattered on the green grass at this Sunday afternoon book festival. Her long lashes hide the clear inner eyelid that will automatically roar in if an unlikely that will automatically close if an unlikely coastal sandstorm roars in. This camel knows her mission. She tolerates the admiring glances and rude remarks like, "What's a camel doing here?" She knows that her human owner, the alpha bull of her herd, is nearby if she needs him. Little can faze her, as she has no natural predators and a nuanced startle reflex, although fluttering fabric and sudden movements may annoy her. Her eyes express a confident view of her place in the world, composed at this moment of a task, the pen that holds her, and something to nibble with a little water on the side. Today, her job is to be a camel at a fair. What she doesn't know is that her blood can work medical miracles. Her flesh is kin to that of million-dollar racing camels. Her organs are debated, and her milk has healed the sick for centuries. She also doesn't know that she's about to launch a movement that will drive her species' price sky high, that people will clamor for the milk she gives, which will help refuel a modern resurgence of her kind. Neither do I. At this moment, she's just a camel, and I'm just a fearful, newly separated single mother. She will inspire me to seek the surprising remedy for my son's autism symptoms and to become a camel milk expert. This creature will throw me into research, dispatch me across the United States, India, and the United Arab Emirates, and send my words to places like Malaysia, Sweden, England, Cyprus, Mongolia, France, and Pakistan. She'll cause scoffing and admiration, inspire scientific research and many products. But now I stand by her broadside, as bored as she is, watching her. She's tall and stolid, seemingly unflappable. Camels are like that, able to keep going without complaint for miles and kilometers, hauling salt, fat-bellied tourists, large milk cans, towing wagons, trucks, and carts draped in glittering scarlet curtains, carrying entire households on their backs. But I don't know this. I just wonder why a camel's here if none of these kids are riding it. I see the long eyelashes blink once. I spot a flapping tent behind her and walk over to investigate. There are small white bottles of camel milk lotion and soaps. I like soap. I lift a smooth, wavy bar to smell it, and the scent of lavender moves lightly across my upper lip. A man in a green baseball cap shifts behind the counter. "Hi," I say, "is that your camel?" "Yes, sure is. We make soap and lotion from camel milk. Very natural and healthy stuff." I try a dab of the white lotion. It's thin and spreads easily, as light as sunshine. Then I ask, "What else do they do with the milk?" I don't know why I'm asking. Perhaps boredom is driving me to prolong the chat, or maybe that's just how I am, always curious. Probably both. They give it to premature babies in hospitals in the Middle East. It's supposed to not cause any allergies. "Really? It's non-allergenic milk?" "It's said to be close to mother's milk, like breast milk." "Thanks." I look at my son Jonah sitting on a nearby slope, knees nestled in the grass as he reads an airplane book. His 4 years of autism therapies have cost $500,000. Right now, he's a happy, blue-eyed 7-year-old charmer fitting few people's idea of autism. But a trace amount of milk can send him into a trance, staring at a wall or laughing at nothing. He can disappear inside his head, or up a ladder, atop a wall, or anywhere. Or one day, I worry, out of his classroom and into special ed. I bring my son to the camel, stand him before the rounded belly and single hump. I tell him, "It's a camel." And he says, "Okay, Mom, I have to find this milk."
Yeah, so after that experience, after meeting the camel, after, you know, that day, how long was it until the book idea took form? Or did it go into an essay or articles, or did, you know, your next book kind of appear and you go, "This is what I have to do"?
Well, at that time, I guess, you know, things were really was flat out wide open in a turmoil because I was going to have to move out of our family home with my son. And I didn't know where we were going to go, what we were going to do. And with a child with autism, they're very complex. You have all these programs, you have school districts, you have everything set up for them, medical care. And of course, I had kind of lost my career, my job opportunities because of taking care of him. And so that's why I did the first book, at least, you know, sharing with people mm-hmm. what they needed to know and using my skills. But then So this, initially, I had no idea that this was going to be anything other than finding this milk. But then as time went along, and I had to do some extreme things like fly it in and connect with people in the desert in Israel, the Bedouins, and get the milk and fly it in and, quote, smuggle it in, which I ended up getting permission from the USDA to do, and seeing how well it worked in my son, astonishingly well, I did decide, okay, I have to write an article at some point. But I didn't initially because I was too afraid that everybody would kind of bust down the doors at customs and, and cause a problem for my son. But then once I found out that Amish people in America, a couple years later, had started milking camels, I got that milk. I did the same thing as my son. And so then when I knew that American milk and milk from the desert in another country worked the same, it was a scientific insight. Okay, this is what's special about it. And now children all over the world can drink this milk. So I did write an article called Got Camel Milk, and it went viral across the world, and it's kicked off the global movement.
I saw camel milk in Mother's some time ago. Mother's Market, we have this wonderful store here in Orange County called Mother's, and in the freezer section there was camel milk. And I saw it some time ago, a couple of months ago, and I thought, I wonder if this is because of Christina.
Well, yes, you would be right about that. Maybe not that it's in that particular store, but yeah, overall, because that article in 2012 went really viral and was chopped up into a whole bunch of different pieces and languages and really started the whole thing. There had been an existing science article that I didn't know existed when I had this idea, but it didn't really get a lot of play. So it needed to go mainstream so people could, you know, make money off of it and spread the word.
Sure.
And so between the demand for it and the merchants that saw the opportunity and the camel people that saw that they could have a lifeline for their camels, that's what happened.
So I, you know, the book is really interesting to me. It's, you know, I like how the chapters are fairly short, which, you know, makes them kind of biteable, right? You don't have to, I often look at chapters to see how long they are before I read, to see if I'm going to be able to read the whole thing at the sitting, the time that I have. And I like that they're short. And then as you get into the book, there it alternates with chapters that are more informative.
Yes. So I love being a literary writer, but I do have a background, of course, as journalism and then aerospace and telling complex material, but in a readable way. So with A Real Boy, that was a memoir, and I got to use my literary skills, but I also wove information with that. And people said, it reads really fast. I read it in 2 days. I didn't put it down. I read it in 3 days. And that's what I wanted for this book, too. I like the fact that people found if they read things that move quickly, but they still get information, they like that. So I thought that's my goal for this too. So also, since there are so many different people in it and different cultures in different countries and things like that, I wanted to be able to, you know, fit in the whole journey that I took and take you along with me. So thanks for liking the shorter chapters.
Yeah, I do. And I, as I was reading, I was also wondering if this would be considered a hybrid memoir because there's the personal story and there's also the information. Did you think of it that way, or has your agent or publisher talked about it in that way?
We didn't exactly label it that, but I think you could call it that. So it's really a story that is so complicated that it has been difficult to pigeonhole it, which is part of the struggle with selling a book or getting it out there. But I love my publisher because they said, yeah, we're not exactly sure how to market it, but we love it and we're doing this. So, you know, that's the kind of attitude.
How unusual.
I love them. They're wonderful. And New World Library, thank you. And but that's the story of camel milk. It seems impossible, but then you do it. And it reaches who it needs. So that's kind of how the book has been, too. But as far as the hybrid part, yes, I have a lot of information in there. But I weave it in a story because people generally cannot, generally people, most of them cannot really absorb or want to read. And who can blame them unless there's a story attached? They can't get information. They can't really access the need for dense information until you put it in little bite-sized pieces that are easy to read and they can and get the story. Why should it benefit others or people? So that was part of my goal, put it in the story and then they can get what they need out of it in easy form.
So does that come from your background in fiction writing? Because your MFA is in fiction, isn't it?
Yes, I did have the whole background, you know, in writing, Pentagon, aerospace, all that kind of stuff. But then I always, of course, was born to be a reader and a writer. So it was my, you know, I did get my fiction. I wanted to write, of course, we all do, the great American novel. And so I had written a novel during my MFA, but then autism entered our lives. So I did not stay with that. But using those, you know, fiction techniques, when you're telling a story, having characters, having dialogue, having interplay within the characters. Like there are a couple of characters in my book and they're real people. Mm-hmm. And first they had a friendship. One is an Amish turned Mennonite farmer and the other is a young Saudi entrepreneur. They come from completely different worlds, but they had a lot in common. So part of the thread is what happens to them as they mm-hmm. meet, develop their relationship, and then how it turns out at the end. So I feel like that's a little bit of a way to put, you know, narrative and structure into mm-hmm. a book that may be more, you might see it more in fiction, but I like it in memoir.
Did you think at all in that regard of like the A story and the B story?
I wouldn't put it that way, but there are, mm-hmm. I said, you know, the primary story was kind of, it started with my son, mm-hmm. but it was just inspired by him. And we do check in with him in my, you know, my personal life through the book. Mm-hmm. But it's really kind of, I took people with me. I guess it's more my story, but I wanted to showcase everybody else's stories as I moved through their sure. worlds, my worlds, their worlds, and we created a community together. So, you know, that's part of the thing. Like, okay, so it's got to be through my lens because everybody mm-hmm. asked me in person. Like, that helped a lot. You did what? Where did you go? How does this work? What, mm-hmm. what? So I thought, okay, it's got to be me as the lens, but it's to showcase, you know, how I move through the world and you come along with me.
And it started as a proposal?
It started as...
Or did you write the whole book?
I wrote a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I was lucky I got away without a proposal for a real boy, but now a lot of people are really into proposals. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a lot of it. But then I did figure I would do a proposal because it had so much nonfiction in it, narrative nonfiction mm-hmm. in it. Mm-hmm. And then I did do the proposal, but a lot of it was written. So that's one reason why we went to publishing, went to press pretty quickly. So it was sold in December, and they said, we can go to press in October. So that's pretty fast for a book because they said a lot of it's already written. Hmm. Of course, though, we did intense. I had to write more chapters, and then sure. you blend them in together, and then you decide what to leave in and take out. And then, of course, a lot of, with this book, there is some science in it. And so mm-hmm. you're going to read it. You're not going to know, you know, particularly that you're reading science. I just put, you know, little bits in here and there. But that took a lot of intense work and effort to put the science in readable format. And then, right. of course, all the citations in the back. So you can right. hand it to a doctor or somebody like that.
Yeah, I was noticing the notes or the citations in the back, and there's so many. Oh, my gosh.
Ooh, chapter 15. That was my my chapter, my showpiece science chapter.
The Power of Camel Milk.
The Power of Camel Milk. And, of course, it's, you know, starts with the personal story, and then people that come up and say, oh, guess what? My 7-year-old son was attacking people so badly he was putting people in the hospital. Mm-hmm. But he's got camel milk, and he's changed. And so then I say, why? What's behind mm-hmm. that? And that's mm-hmm. where I'm able to share with the reader pretty much a bite-sized piece of all what they'd want to know or a doctor would want to know without overwhelming them. So that whole mm-hmm. chapter 15, is only 7 print pages, mm-hmm. which looking back at all the twisting agony that it cost to, you know, dig not only deeply in PubMed and other resources and things, but then mm-hmm. also my own knowledge really formed the basis of the whole book. To put it all in together with the citations in the proper form without overwhelming the reader, which I don't think it does. But then enough for any medical people to say, oh, she's
right.
got it.
Right.
So that took a lot of effort, but I'm really happy. So now I can point to people, what you're asking, chapter 15.
Mm-hmm. I love the photos, too.
I'm so excited that they put 40-some.
I mean, in color.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
40-some photos in here of the gorgeous animals in their environments and the lovely camel caregivers. So, you know, you see my son and myself, mm-hmm. and then of course you see the beautiful animals, and you see the Bedouin woman from the Judean desert, you know, with her face wrapped, carrying mm-hmm. a bucket, mm-hmm. which could be camel milk. You see the joyous, glorious bond between camels and their caregivers in color. And, of course, the decorated, beautiful animals in Rajasthan, where I spent a month on the ground with the herders. And those are some of my favorites because, mm-hmm. I mean, India is one of my favorite countries in the world. And you cannot ask for a place with a better style, love of beauty. And I feel that the photos were able to help, you know, bring to life what I was trying to do my word painting with in the book.
If you just tuned in, I'm with Christina Adams. Her book is Camel Crazy, A Quest for Miracles and the Mysterious World of Camels, published by New World Library. How were you received in Rajasthan? And throughout India?
I've been so honored that as I've moved through the cultural cross currents of camels and camel milk and camel worlds, that it's been a beautiful experience overall. There are camel caregivers. A lot of them are Muslim. A lot of them are Hindu. In America, a lot of them are Amish or Mennonite. So those are cultures that can be traditionally somewhat, you know, patriarchal, and have different rules for, you know, women than men. But I have never met really with anything but great respect and great welcome.
Yeah.
And so one of the good things about Camel Crazy, it shows how people around the world can connect for a good cause and everybody can not only get along well, but then benefit for what they want out of it. Like the Indian camel herders, this particular group called the Rika, they're struggling. So they need help. They need awareness. They didn't know what, you know, their camel milk could do for this modern thing called autism and all that. So I was over there speaking to them and, you know, translated into Hindi. And I felt very honored that, you know, after I did a lot of my speaking, I get passed a special little cigarette called a bidi. And I don't smoke, but I did in that case. And I impressed them by blowing smoke rings. And so I think that some gestures speak louder than words.
Yeah.
So it's been a great experience overall.
Was this the first chapter? I mean, you do have a foreword by Joel Salatin, and then you have your introduction. But what you read to us, was that always the first chapter of the book?
No, because I didn't really, for a while it was, but then I changed it. I thought, you know what, the milk thing is just, people are just not, I can't lead off with that yet. Mm-hmm. I have to lead off with something about the camel because I saw there's a gap on the shelf. There's nothing about a camel on the shelf. There's a few little niche books out there, but no mainstream book. So I thought maybe I'll start with that. So I had a part about like maybe the science of the book or what, you know, the camel. But then when I sat down to finally get this manuscript out the door before I even had an agent or pitched it, I was like, it's got to start here. That's where everybody wants to know, and that's what we have to do. So it became the first chapter, then it stayed.
So we talked earlier about what gave you trouble in writing this book, and you said you found something in a section in the book that you wanted to talk about that was particularly difficult for whatever reason. I don't know, maybe digesting the information and putting in readable form or just writing the chapter or whatever.
Well, we talked about chapter 15, which was the crown jewel of putting a lot of effort into it, but did exactly what I wanted it to do, which is the science chapter.
Right.
But there were a lot of things that were not easy with writing the book because so many cultures. So I was up late at night when India comes online, you know, or the Middle East comes online. It's 10 or 11 at night in America, in California.
Yeah.
So boom, my WhatsApp starts lighting up. My Facebook Messenger starts lighting up. And that's when I can get my questions answered. So I'm, I'll say like, let's say chapter, you know, like page 192, where I'm in India and I was honored to see a performance about their, what they call their small god, Babuji. Babuji is kind of like their patron saint of camels.
Okay.
And I'm in the village and I'm watching this amazing performance, which I'd read about but never thought I'd see in my life. But then Hanwant, who is a man who's a real leader, he's a respected Rajput local in the same clan as the Maharaja of Jodhpur. And he's there, and he's somebody that I know, is a friend of mine. And he was explaining, you know, we'll have special performance, Hanwant says. The Bopa will present the story of how Babuji born and how he brings camels to Rajasthan. And so I was there and I loved it. You know, I videotaped it, which always helps, you know, recording with when you're doing reporting. But when I'm home, I have to sort through this because we're talking about their faith.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're talking about the faith of someone like the Rika, who believe they were created by Lord Shiva to take care of camels, and then Pabuji is their other god, and they actually opened our conference there with a special kind of little, you know, kickoff was for Pabuji, and had the statue and light the candles and things like that. You have to be careful. So I had to dig deep into Pabuji history, and it's very complicated, nor do I want to misinterpret anything. Mm-hmm. So I pretty much went with, you know, Pabuji is a god revered by local herders. He was reportedly a landlord or noble. And then Hanwan explains to me, you know, Pabuji went to place now in Pakistan area. At the time, Rika not know about female camels. They only know male camels. So Pabuji and some Rika and Bopa went, and they bring back female camels to Rika. And that's when the Rika started bringing camels. But Pabuji returned, forsaking his own wedding to fight enemies who took his northern compatriots' cows. He go and he died there for the cow, Hanwan says sadly. So Pabuji is a deity now, with his own lengthy legend. Okay, that's one paragraph. Boy, did it take me a lot of time to figure out, you know, how to say that properly without, you know, getting into any interpretations.
Right.
So that's just one little tiny example.
Did you have anybody go over the book for things like that to, like, what did you do about, like, making sure?
Well, this, again, like, this is a great thing that I'm glad we're talking about as far as writing. So when you are dealing with other people's cultures and other people's faiths, which I always do, as it's an honor for me, I actually thought I want to use a sensitivity reader or sensitivity readers. Mm-hmm. So I did do that. So not only did I use, you know, actually consult people repeatedly, like I said, you know, late at night, early in the morning, whenever they were awake and I'm awake, back and forth. I mean, that went on for months, you know, to make sure that I'm getting it from them. And that's another reason I don't change their English. Their English is their English. So I don't mess around with it. I put it exactly the way they said it. So they get to say the things they want to say without me trying to interpret it. But second of all, like I said, the sensitivity readers. So I did use sensitivity readers. I had one main person who her name is Madhushri Ghosh, and she's a wonderful literary writer herself. Who is Indian. And so she is, she did a great service with the overall sensitivity read. But then for each different type of person or situation, I use different ones. So, you know, if there's a Somali people, you know, people that I use, people like from the Somali culture, you know, Muslim people, a Syrian person, or other different people. So I had did a lot of sensitivity checking and reading to make sure. And you know what? I advise that.
Yeah.
If you were doing these things where you're talking about other people's culture, I'm really glad I did it. And I would definitely suggest that people do that with their work.
Did anything come out of that that surprised you, where your readers went, you know, maybe we should do this a little differently here? Or, you know, whereas if you didn't have them and you sent the book out there, someone might come back to you and go, wait a minute.
Well, I'm glad to say nothing big, but it could have been little things that, like, would embarrass me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one thing I think was, because this was something that was actually really fascinating. There's the Quran says, you know, camels are special. You know, will they not look at the camel, how it is made? You know, we have made it for you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something very special to them. So a lot of Muslim people are very aware that the camel is something special. Different, it turns out. So I had a quote in there about, you know, a lot of people say this thing about the camel smiles. The camel smiles because he knows, you know, the certain names of Allah. The camel smiles because he knows it and he won't tell you, or it's only reserved for him. And so I'd heard that. But then I asked, you know, one Muslim friend of mine about that. And he's like, no, this is not true. And then he put me on the phone with an imam who says, oh, no, that's not true. It's made up by the West. But then I was like, no, I've heard this from other places. So I had to dig deep into, you know, other Muslims from other countries who some are more, you know, rural nomadic people. And so it turns out they all have their own interpretation of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I handled that very carefully. So I said, well, this is what some say. This is what some say. And in the back, I even have a footnote. To make sure that, you know, the imam got his say and other people got their say. So, yeah, I wanted to be very careful with that. I'm very glad I did that.
I like that there's also an index, which you don't always find in books that, excuse me, are leaning toward memoir. And I'm curious about the index. Did your publisher just decide they were going to do that? Or did you say, you know, we really need an index? Or how'd that come about?
Well, my publisher has been fantastic. They have been the perfect company to do this book, New World Library. So they did want to do an index, and they knew that it would be a book that people would can take mm-hmm. seriously. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to be in great shape for that, which I did too. So together it was a great collaboration, and they did the indexing, which is great. I mean, it's a special skill.
Yeah.
And I was so on deadline with this. I mean, mm-hmm. pretty much the whole past 2 years I've been nothing but writing and working, even traveling. I'm on my computer like a lot. Boston, New York City, Croatia, like I'm on that computer. So yeah, they did a great job with it. And then the footnotes also I really appreciate. And that's where people that want to dig deeply into, mm-hmm. you know, what I say in the text, they can go into those notes, and every chapter has their footnotes. And then the other great part is it does have a user's guide in the back, which I brought to their awareness. I said, look, you know, when people read this book, they want camel milk, mm-hmm. not only for autism, but right. for all these other disorders, right. Like anything with inflammation, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, gut issues, bowel issues, failure to thrive, you know, all kinds of things it's helping with these days, diabetes type 1 and 2. So I said, they're going to want it. So I need to have a guide in the back on, you know, different mm-hmm. things that it's used for, the recommended amounts. And this is all science-based and observational-based. And, you know, some of the possible things you need to think about, a smoothie recipe, and then where to buy camel milk. So they supported that. And it turns out, I didn't know, you know, how that would be received. Like, oh, you have this guy in the back, you know, of a memoir mm-hmm. narrative. People love it. So yeah. It's been really, really good.
Well, that's why, I mean, that was one of the other things about it being a hybrid, you know, where it's your story, but it's also a way other people can use it. And there's sort of, you know, things they can use, like the user's guide, where to find it, how to go about this, you know. It's interesting. I wonder if some of the doctors, early on, you talk about one doctor who called you stupid, I think, and your son's like, she's not stupid. But and then you decided that wasn't the doctor for you anymore. Have you been in touch with him since to see if he's changed his mind about things?
I have heard that he's changed his mind about uh-huh. things. One of the last chapter in the book is called The World Wakes Up to Camels. And that's where I get to make my sort of clarion call for, you know, the value of including mm-hmm. women's voices, mothers' right. voices, people from, you know, cultures that we don't get to hear from's mm-hmm. voices, indigenous people, nomadic peoples. I mean, we're smart. We're not any less intelligent than you. Because you went to medical school, you may know some more things, but and you may be a critical thinker, but perhaps you're not, you've lost some of the open-minded mm-hmm. investigative mm-hmm. qualities that I feel a physician should have.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm the one now, I wrote a medical journal article in 2013 that got a lot of science attention. It's now been cited around 13 times. Hmm. And I speak at, you know, science conferences. So, you know, what can you say? Mm-hmm. I feel like voices like mine should be heard.
Do you see yourself going back to fiction at all? Or has this become such a passion, such a calling that, you know, I don't know if you're thinking about the next book or what's coming up in the future.
I do think about the next book, but I'm still doing a lot of media. We've done mm-hmm. about 65 interviews, radio, TV, and mm-hmm. some print and things so far. And it's still going on. I mean, the book came out basically at the beginning of November, and this is February. See, I'm looking lost. Mm-hmm. When is it? February? Do we have Valentine's Day? And so, you know, this week I have 3 shows, and it's still going on. Speaking events are going on. I'm kind of booked through a lot of April and going into May. And so I do think about writing a novel again. I mean, I do have something that would mm-hmm. be interesting to write about that way. But I guess it just, I'm going to give this everything. I put so much time into this camel
sure.
thing. And it's never been about money. It's not, you don't really right. get, it's all right. pretty much volunteer work.
Right.
That I just want to, you know, put the stopper in the bottle and throw it out in the ocean mm-hmm. and push those waves behind
right.
it.
Right.
And then I can
right.
move on.
Yeah. Well, what about, let's talk a little bit about the writing and the revision, because, you know, it's such a big deal, I think, revising, and it's kind of the most unpleasant aspect for most writers. It's like, it's fun to get the draft, and then you have to work at it, right? And, refine and revise and throw things out. Talk a little bit about that. I'm curious if there's anything you left out. And then sort of what your revision process was with the book.
Great question. I guess I'm lucky in that I mind revisions less than most people. Mm-hmm. I don't mind the nitty gritty and getting in there, unless, of course, you're talking about some of the deep science stuff when mm-hmm. I'm, oh, here we go again and again and again. But that's fine. I mean, it's something I even do. Like, I'm even peer reviewing articles now. I've been asked to be a peer reviewer for science journals. And it's, like, oh, am I doing that?
Is that fun?
I guess I am. It is. It is because I only get asked for subject matter that I'm familiar with. So, that is kind of, who would ever think that, an English major with an MFA is going to be doing that? But you just never know. But so, I don't mind revising as much as a lot of people, but there comes a point when you have to make decisions. So with this book, there are chapters that I wrote that are not in it. I did take a lot of material out. There are a lot of relationships and narrative threads that I had to get rid of. Mm-hmm. But I did write a chapter also, a deep dive into formula and, for infants and milk and all this kind of stuff. And so that didn't really fit in the book, but it's got great valuable information. I don't know what I'm going to do with that.
Could it be an article of some sort?
It could. Formula is a sensitive topic, so mm-hmm. there'll be a lot of gatekeeping to get anything out there. But I know people need the information. I did have to throw a lot of things out. But here's what I learned through a real boy. Like, through a real boy, I think I took out, that was a complete manuscript. We took out 75 pages and no one misses them. Mm-hmm. I don't even miss them anymore. I did for a while, but then I never did. So same thing with this. Cut. But then it was great because when we sold the book, my editor said, what? We've never seen this topic before. We've never seen it. I don't want you to feel hampered, like you have to stick with, mm-hmm. Everybody says 80,000 words now or whatever it is, a book has to be, X pages, which is a thing, they don't want to go into long stuff. So generally, it'll be under 300 or something, but she's like, we've never seen this before. I want you to just write it and feel like you're getting that information in there and mm-hmm. then we can decide. So that was a wonderful editorial gift.
How many words is it? Do you know?
Oh, I forgot about the word count, but basically, here, I'm looking at the book right now, and the very last page is 267. So it came in, pretty short, but pretty dense. But, mm-hmm. I am getting that same response from audiences that say, I can't put it down. I'm reading it fast. I'm giving it to somebody. I'm buying 7 copies for somebody. I'm reading it fast. I can't put it down. And that's what I wanted. That's what I got with the first one. And I'm getting it with the second one.
Yeah. No, it is a fast read, which is interesting and good. So good to, because, you can get into subject matter and think, oh, how much do I have to invest in this? And is it going to be fun? And it's a really fun read.
Well, thank you. That's the thing. If something's not fun to read, people just aren't going to read it.
Yeah.
And I made a decision early on to make my work accessible. I enjoy literary writing. I enjoy, mm-hmm. In-depth science narrative, nonfiction writing. I really do. But I want my work to be accessible.
Sure.
So I made that decision. And I even got a really nice review on Amazon the other day. The person, I don't know who it is, they're in Japan. They said, this book was so easy to read, even for somebody with English second language like me. Hmm. And I thought it was only a one sentence review. I'm like, yes.
Well, there's lots of sensory detail, lots of description, lots of visuals. You write in scene a lot, which is a wonderful thing in all writing, right? Unless you're writing a white paper or something where it doesn't belong. But I really appreciated that about this book. There's just, so many chapters are in scene.
I really wanted to do that.
And were you paying attention to that?
Yes, I wanted to do that because mm-hmm. the places I've been and what I've experienced are pretty astonishing. How many people get to do some of the things I've done in this book? How many people get to sit in a room full of, Somali immigrants and elders and mm-hmm. hear the lost stories of their culture?
Right.
How many people get to go into the depths of Rajasthan and, go out in the morning with the camels and drink a narcotic tea you know, and, you know, how many people get to stay in the world's most beautiful hotels in India, mm-hmm. you know, a beautiful palace sure. turned hotel, or the next thing I'm out in the sheep herders, the women sheep herders hut, you know, mm. and they're cooking for me, right next to the sheep pen, you know, so how can I not offer that to people? And then also my son, you know, he's in here too. I mean, the beauty of a little boy, and why mm-hmm. do parents go to these crazy depths for their children? I mean, now mm-hmm. he's 22 and he's in, you know, community college and smart as heck and hilarious and very supportive of this. But, you know, back when they're young, they're so vulnerable
right.
and they just get their hooks in you. And I just wanted to let people know, you know, this is your child and, you know, they're dependent on you and they're so darling. And so when I write about him and how it's so crucial mm-hmm. that he starts talking more or that he starts talking better or that I can see who is he, you know, mm-hmm. beyond this behavior, which in his case, a lot was driven by what he was eating.
Right.
Who is he? And I want him to get that chance. So, yeah, writing in scene was really good for me. And so one thing I would advise people, I love working off recording. So mm-hmm. It's a very visually, I get great prompts from actually watching my interviews, mm-hmm. Watching the people talk. Or just taking pictures. Pictures are great, but video is really, really good. So, I mean, I feel like that's a great, I can write without that, but I feel like there's a really good advantage to bringing back those sensory mm. things if you're going to record, even if you're writing a novel.
Mm-hmm.
I might go to that spot and I would probably record and see, mm. you know, what the sound of the wind and the grass, mm-hmm. you know, the texture of the dirt,
sure.
things like that.
Will you keep a journal as well? Do you do that? Were you doing that throughout?
I did not keep a journal, but what I did all along, because after I started writing about the milk and the response was so, you know, global and incredible, I thought, yeah, maybe I will do the book. Maybe I'll do a book. So I did start really interviewing people and along the way. So I've sat and interviewed people and put that in. And then I have videotaped a lot of these things that I've done along the way. So that's sort of my journal.
Hmm. We have a few minutes left with Christina Adams. Her book is Camel Crazy, A Quest for Miracles and the Mysterious World of Camels. Has anything really surprising come out of doing this book, whether having to do with your writing, having to do with, you know, the promotion, having to do with people you've met, people that were affected? I don't know. Anything you didn't expect?
I guess I, you know, I'm glad to see that Barnes & Noble has it on the front table as must-read nonfiction. Mm. Like, that's a writer's goal.
Yeah.
So when that happened, I was like, I didn't know if this would happen. But it did.
Yeah.
The Public Library of Science, DNA Genetics blog, they did a whole feature on the book, and then that writer, being a geneticist, Dr. Ricky Lewis, went further and asked me about camel genetics, which isn't something I knew a bunch about, but she did the research on herself and connected the dots on, you know, the genetics of the camel and why the milk works and things like that. So, you know, when you're on the PLOS, that's a mm-hmm. big deal and that kind of thing. So I guess that's been the great part. And so many great blurbs. I have great blurbs mm-hmm. from great writers. Cy Montgomery, Soul of an Octopus.
Yeah.
Joel Salatin, author of like 13 books, a very famous man.
Well, talk about that, about getting blurbs, because that can be kind of a dicey thing, asking writers to read your manuscript and get blurbs.
Yeah. And
did that help sell the book, do you think? Did you have them before or did they come after you got the book deal?
Well, that's a good thing to ask. So for writers, I would like to let you know, I found out the hard way on the first book that, hey, we need you to get all these signed releases from people in your book, and you've got a week to do it,
mm-hmm.
you know. So the second time I learned, okay, early up front, I'm getting permissions, both for visual and print
mm-hmm.
and rights of, you know, so to use their words. So I got a lot of that up front. And I did the same thing with some blurbs. I said to a lot of people, hey, would you be willing to blurb this? Some people said automatically, yes. Some people are like, yeah, once I read the manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are like, when you just, you know, you're shining right. those people on. Okay. But most people were very great. So I had a whole list in the proposal of about 20 people that had already committed.
Who would do it.
Who would do it. Mm-hmm. Who'd already committed or might commit. And so I broke that down in the proposal because it was like a 50-page proposal.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, when the time comes, like, oh, we sold the book, we got to get blurbs going. Then the time becomes very short. and some a lot of famous people are pretty backed up. So you need to get with them early on. So, you know, what did I do? I went to Twitter. I put it out on publicly because I'm not a person that puts a lot of stuff on publicly. And I hate asking people for anything. But, you know, a couple people I connected with through Twitter, a couple people I wrote online. And it was kind of interesting. A lot of, you know, some famous people never answer you. But Gloria Steinem, who I met once when my first book came out, and she said, oh, I heard about your book. I recommend. I'm like, what? You know about my book? So I thought, I'll write to Gloria again. I did. Not that I have her personal email, but I did. And her staff wrote back. She's super busy right now, but, you know, she's so sorry. You know, sorry she can't do it. She's got her own book, this and that, but, you know, wishing you good luck. I'm like, wow, so sweet. And then some people, they do. Like the director for Slow Food International, which is a very prestigious food organization. He's like, oh, I love it. I'm all over it. I'm doing it, like, in 2 days. Yeah, that was pretty great. So you just never know. You can try. Now, they do say a lot of really famous people do not do blurbs because it's just they're too overwhelming for them. Right. And so I do understand that. I have a good Joan Collins story. I heard Joan Collins loves camels. And so I was like, I'm going to ask Joan Collins. So I actually found her literary agent's email, and we wrote him an email. And he's like, I didn't know she loved camels, but I'll ask her. But then, you know, we didn't ever hear anything, so that's fine. But it was kind of fun. It was very polite that he wrote back, too. Thank you, Mr. Agent.
Yeah, it's nice. So with promotion, I mean, do you enjoy that aspect of it?
I do like interacting with people who want to talk about the book or need assistance or whatever. Sure. I do like that. I have done, you know, PR stuff, and I still do. So it's easy for me. I do not mind, and I actually enjoy doing speaking to audiences, to Q&As, to all that. So I've done that a lot with this book, from audiences at a Texas ranch to a I just did the Camel Lid Conference in Sacramento. I didn't know there was one, but they don't know about camels. They just knew llamas and stuff. They're like, please come and tell us about camels. So I do enjoy that. But I also really like writing. So I haven't been writing for a while, except I have an essay in Ravishly and, you know, lots of PR stuff more than the writing. But yeah, I'm comfortable with that. And of course, I have a website, which is ChristinaAdamsAuthor.com. And so I try to, I have some videos on there. I have some of my other work. So I do intend to get back to the writing at some point, but I do, you know, do other things as well. So I do like a lot of video interviews. Autism Live is a great global platform for those kind of folks. And I do a lot on their show and stuff like that.
Well, I would say again, back to, I mean, with this book, even without a child with autism, it's interesting. You know, it's an interesting memoir.
Thank you.
I would think anybody who is, especially writers writing memoir, could learn a lot from reading this book in terms of structure, in terms of how to tell a story, how to write in scene, which I constantly harp on, right, with students. It's like, write a scene.
Great.
Don't tell it, you know, put it in a scene. Is it filmable? You know?
A lot of this is scene. Yeah. And it is a book that I didn't want it to just be a niche book about autism or camels or whatever. So it's really a global, it's a story that started locally and it went global, and it's a passionate book. I mean, I think you can hear the passion of the people in it.
Yeah. And yours.
Yeah.
And yours. We have a minute left. I wonder if you have any advice for the writers listening, maybe the writers of memoir.
Well, with memoir, and I actually am going to be teaching a memoir class at Beyond Baroque in Venice, California on May 9th. So it's a good thing you're asking. I'm starting to think about this. With memoir, you have to first identify, is this a memoir or is it just going to be like a family memory, or is it just something I need to work out personally? Is it going to be a memoir? And it can be. I mean, you just have to decide, am I writing, you know, am I willing to write? Am I willing to open myself up? Am I willing to put other people out there too? Because you are going to inevitably put other people in your story. But then you have to decide, okay, where do I want to go with it? Do I want to just do it for myself, which is totally fine? Do I want to try to get it published? So first of all, you have to write. You have to write it, because you're not going to know what that story is going to do until you actually write it.
Thank you for being here. It's fun to have you in the studio. I never do studio interviews.
That's great. And so, I hope to connect with everyone. I'm on Twitter at Christina Think, and I'm on Facebook at Christina Adams Author, and Instagram and all the usual suspects.
Great. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And thank you for being with us. You have been listening to Writers on Writing. This show, along with many others, will be podcast. I know Stitcher is working, so get the Stitcher app, and when this goes live, it'll be on Stitcher, and eventually we'll fix the iTunes feed. And again, the archive is writersonwriting.blogspot.com. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Come back next week. We'll have more for you.